A Murder is Announced by Agatha Christie. Read by Rosemary Leach. Chapter 1. A Murder is Announced. Between 7:30 and 8:30 every morning except Sundays, Johnny Butt made the round of the village of Chipping Cleghorn on his bicycle, whistling vociferously through his teeth, and alighting at each house or cottage to shove through the letterbox such morning papers as had been ordered by the occupants of the house in question from Mr. Totman, stationer of the High Street. Thus, at Colonel and Mrs. Easterbrook's, he delivered the Times and the Daily Graphic. At Mrs. Swettenham's, he left the Times and the Daily Worker. At Miss Hinchcliffe and Miss Murgatroyd's, he left the Daily Telegraph and the News Chronicle. At Miss Blacklock's, he left the Telegraph, the Times, and the Daily Mail. At all these houses, and indeed at practically every house in Chipping Cleghorn, he delivered every Friday a copy of the North Benham News and Chipping Cleghorn Gazette, known locally simply as the Gazette. Thus, on Friday mornings, after a hurried glance at the headlines in the daily paper, International Situation Critical, UNO Meets Today, Bloodhounds Seek Blonde Typist's Killer, Three Collieries Idle, 23 Die of Food Poisoning in Seaside Hotel, etc., most of the inhabitants of Chipping Cleghorn eagerly opened the Gazette and plunged into the local news. After a cursory glance at correspondence, in which the passionate hates and feuds of rural life found full play, 9 out of 10 subscribers then turned to the personal column. Here were grouped together higgledy-piggledy articles for sale or wanted, frenzied appeals for domestic help, innumerable insertions regarding dogs, announcements concerning poultry and garden equipment, and various other items of an interesting nature to those living in the small community of Chipping Cleghorn. This particular Friday, October the 29th, was no exception to the rule. Mrs. Swettenham, pushing back the pretty little grey curls from her forehead, opened the Times, looked with a lacklustre eye at the left-hand centre page, decided that, as usual, if there was any exciting news, the Times had succeeded in camouflaging it in an impeccable manner, took a look at the births, marriages and deaths, particularly the latter, then, her duty done, she put aside the Times and eagerly seized the Chipping Cleghorn Gazette. When her son Edmund entered the room a moment later, she was already deep in the personal column. "Good morning, dear," said Mrs. Swettenham. "Death Medners are selling their Daimler. 1935, that's rather a long time ago, isn't it?" Her son grunted, poured himself out a cup of coffee, helped himself to a couple of kippers, sat down at the table and opened the Daily Worker, which he propped up against the toast rack. "Bull Mastiff Puppies," read out Mrs. Swettenham. "I really don't know how people manage to feed big dogs nowadays. I really don't. Selina Lawrence is advertising for a cook again. I could tell her it's just a waste of time advertising in these days. She hasn't put her address, only a box number. It's quite fatal. I could have told her so. Servants simply insist on knowing where they are going. They like a good address. False teeth. I can't think why false teeth are so popular. Best prices paid. Beautiful bulbs, our special selection. Oh, they sound rather cheap. Here's a girl wants an interesting post, would travel, I dare say. Who wouldn't? Dachshunds. I've never really cared for Dachshunds myself. I don't mean because they're German, because we've got over all that. I just don't care for them, that's all. Yes, Mrs. Finch?" The door had opened to admit the head and torso of a grim-looking female in an aged velvet beret. "Good morning, ma'am," said Mrs. Finch. "Can I clear?"
"Not yet. We haven't finished," said Mrs. Swettenham. "Not quite finished," she added ingratiatingly.
Casting a look at Edmund and his paper, Mrs. Finch sniffed and withdrew.
"I've only just begun," said Edmund, just as his mother remarked. "I do wish you wouldn't read that horrid paper, Edmund. Mrs. Finch doesn't like it at all." I don't see what my political views have to do with Mrs. Finch. And it isn't, pursued Mrs. Swettenham, as though you were a worker. You don't do any work at all. That's not in the least true, said Edmund indignantly. I'm writing a book. I meant real work, said Mrs. Swettenham. And Mrs. Finch does matter. If she takes a dislike to us and won't come, who else could we get? Advertise in the Gazette, said Edmund, grinning. I've just told you that's no use. Oh, dear me. Nowadays, unless one has an old nanny in the family who will go into the kitchen and do everything, one is simply sunk. Well, why haven't we an old nanny? How remiss of you not to have provided me with one. What were you thinking about? You had an idea. No foresight, murmured Edmund. Mrs. Swettenham was once more deep in the personal column. Second-hand motor mower for sale. Now I wonder... Oh, goodness, what a price! More Dachshunds. Do write or communicate desperate woggles. What silly nicknames people have. Cocker Spaniels. Oh, do you remember darling Susie, Edmund? She really was human. Understood every word you said to her. Sheraton sideboard for sale. Genuine family antique. Mrs. Lucas Dyer's Hall. What a liar that woman is. Sheraton, indeed. Mrs. Swettenham sniffed and then continued her reading. All a mistake, darling. Undying love. Friday as usual. J. I suppose they've had a lover's quarrel. Or do you think it's a code for burglars? More Dachshunds. Really, I do think people have gone a little crazy about breeding Dachshunds. I mean, there are other dogs. Your Uncle Simon used to breed Manchester Terriers. They're such graceful little things. I do like a dog with legs. Lady going abroad will sell her navy two-piece suiting. No measurements or price given. A marriage is announced... No! A murder? What? Well, I never... Edmund, listen to this. A murder is announced and will take place on Friday, October the 29th at Little Paddock's at 6:30 p.m. Friends, please accept this, the only intimation. What an extraordinary thing. Edmund!
What's that?
Edmund looked up from his newspaper. Friday, October the 29th... Well, that's today. Let me see. Her son took the paper from her. What does it mean? Mrs. Swettenham asked with lively curiosity. Edmund Swettenham rubbed his nose doubtfully.
Oh, some sort of party, I suppose. The murder game, that kind of thing.
Oh, said Mrs. Swettenham doubtfully. It seems a very odd way of doing it. Just sticking it in the advertisements like that. Not at all like Letitia Blacklock, who always seemed to be such a sensible woman.
Probably got up by the bright young things she has in the house.
It's very short notice. Today? Do you think we're just supposed to go?
Well, it says, friends, please accept this, the only intimation, her son pointed out.
Well, I think these newfangled ways of giving invitations are very tiresome, said Mrs. Swettenham decidedly.
Well, all right, Mother, you needn't go.
No, agreed Mrs. Swettenham.
There was a pause.
Do you really want that last piece of toast, Edmund?
I should have thought my being properly nourished mattered more than letting that old hag clear the table.
Shh, dear, she'll hear you. Edmund, what happens at a murder game?
Oh, I don't know exactly. They pin pieces of paper upon you or something. No, I think you draw them out of a hat. And somebody's the victim and somebody else is the detective. Then they turn the lights out and somebody taps you on the shoulder and then you scream and lie down and sham dead.
It sounds quite exciting.
Probably a beastly bore. I'm not going.
Nonsense, Edmund, said Mrs. Swettenham resolutely. I'm going, and you're coming with me. That's settled. "Archie," said Mrs. Easterbrook to her husband, "listen to this."
Colonel Easterbrook paid no attention because he was already snorting with impatience over an article in the Times. "The trouble with these fellows is," he said, "none of them knows the first thing about India. Not the first thing."
"Well, I know, dear, I know."
"If they did, they wouldn't write such piffle."
"Yes, I know. Archie, do listen. A murder is announced and will take place on Friday, October the 29th, that's today, at Little Paddock's at 6:30 p.m. Friends, please accept this, the only intimation."
She paused triumphantly. Colonel Easterbrook looked at her indulgently, but without much interest. "Murder game," he said.
"Oh.
Well, that's all it is. Mind you," he unbent a little, "it can be very good fun if it's well done. But it needs good organising by someone who knows the ropes. You draw lots. One person's the murderer, and nobody knows who. Lights out. Murderer chooses his victim. The victim has to count 20 before he screams. Then the person who's chosen to be the detective takes charge. Questions everybody. Where they were, what they were doing, tries to trip the real fella up. Yes, it's a good game. Yeah, if the detective knows something about police work."
"Like you, Archie. You had all those interesting cases to try in your district."
Colonel Easterbrook smiled indulgently and gave his moustache a complacent twirl.
"Yes, Laura," he said. "I dare say I could give them a hint or two."
And he straightened his shoulders.
"Miss Blacklock ought to have asked you to help her in getting the thing up."
The Colonel snorted. "Oh, well, she's got that young cub staying with her. Expect this is his idea, nephew or something. Funny idea, though, sticking it in the paper."
"It was in the personal column. We might never have seen it. I suppose it is an invitation, Archie."
"Well, funny kind of invitation. I can tell you one thing. They can count me out."
"Oh, Archie!"
Mrs. Easterbrook's voice rose in a shrill wail. "At short notice. For all they know, I might be busy."
"But you're not, are you, darling?"
Mrs. Easterbrook lowered her voice persuasively.
"And I do think, Archie, that you really ought to go, just to help poor Miss Blacklock out. I'm sure she's counting on you to make the thing a success. I mean, you know so much about police work and procedure. The whole thing'll fall flat if you don't go and help and make it a success. After all, one must be neighbourly."
Mrs. Easterbrook put her synthetic blonde head on one side and opened her blue eyes very wide. "Well, of course, if you put it like that, Laura." Colonel Easterbrook twirled his grey moustache again importantly and looked with indulgence on his fluffy little wife. Mrs. Easterbrook was at least 30 years younger than her husband.
"If you put it like that, Laura," he said,
"I really do think it's your duty, Archie," said Mrs. Easterbrook solemnly.
The Chipping Cleghorn Gazette had also been delivered at Boulders, the picturesque three cottages knocked into one, inhabited by Miss Hinchcliffe and Miss Murgatroyd.
"Hinch?"
"What is it, Murgatroyd?"
"Where are you?"
"Hen house."
"Oh."
Paddling gingerly through the long wet grass, Miss Amy Murgatroyd approached her friend. The latter, attired in corduroy slacks and battle-dress tunic, was conscientiously stirring in handfuls of balancer meal to a repellently steaming basin full of cooked potato peelings and cabbage stumps. She turned her head with its short, manlike crop and weather-beaten countenance toward her friend. Miss Murgatroyd, who was fat and amiable, wore a checked tweed skirt and a shapeless pullover of brilliant royal blue. Her curly bird's nest of grey hair was in a good deal of disorder, and she was slightly out of breath.
"In the Gazette," she panted. "Just listen. What can it mean? A murder is announced and will take place on Friday, October the 29th, at Little Paddock's at 6:30 p.m. Friends, please accept this, the only intimation."
She paused, breathless as she finished reading, and awaited some authoritative pronouncement.
"Daft," said Miss Hinchcliffe.
Yes, but what do you think it means?
Well, it means a drink, anyway, said Miss Hinchcliffe.
You think it's a sort of invitation?
Oh, we'll find out what it means when we get there, said Miss Hinchcliffe. Bad sherry, I expect. You'd better get off the grass, Murgatroyd. You've got your bedroom slippers on still. They're soaked.
Oh, dear. Miss Murgatroyd looked down ruefully at her feet. How many eggs today?
7. That damned hen's still broody. I must get her into the coop.
It's a funny way of putting it, don't you think? Amy Murgatroyd asked, reverting to the notice in the Gazette. Her voice was slightly wistful.
But her friend was made of sterner and more single-minded stuff. She was intent on dealing with recalcitrant poultry, and no announcement in a paper, however enigmatic, could deflect her. She squelched heavily through the mud and pounced upon a speckled hen. There was a loud and indignant squawking.
"Give me ducks every time," said Miss Hinchcliffe. "Far less trouble."
"Oh, scrumptious!" said Mrs. Harmon across the breakfast table to her husband, the Reverend Julian Harmon. "There's going to be a murder at Miss Blacklock's."
"A murder?" her husband said, slightly surprised. "When?"
"This afternoon. At least this evening, 6:30. "Oh, bad luck, darling. You've got your preparations for confirmation, then. Oh, it is a shame. And you do so love murders."
"I don't really know what you're talking about, Bunch." Mrs. Harmon, the roundness of whose form and face had early led to the soubriquet of Bunch being substituted for her baptismal name of Diana, handed the Gazette across the table.
"There, all among the second-hand pianos and the old teeth."
"What a very extraordinary announcement."
"Isn't it?" said Bunch happily.
"You wouldn't think Miss Blacklock cared about murders and games and things, would you? I suppose it's young Simmonses put her up to it. Though I should have thought Julia Simmons would find murders rather crude. Still, there it is, and I do think, darling, it's a shame you can't be there. Anyway, I'll go and I'll tell you all about it. Though it's rather wasted on me, because I don't really like games that happen in the dark. They frighten me, and I do hope I shan't have to be the one who's murdered. If someone suddenly puts a hand on my shoulder and whispers, 'You're dead,' I know my heart will give such a big bump that perhaps it really might kill me. Do you think that's likely?"
"No, Bunch. I think you're going to live to be an old, old woman. With me.
And die on the same day and be buried in the same grave. That would be lovely." Bunch beamed from ear to ear at this agreeable prospect.
"You seem very happy, Bunch," said her husband, smiling.
"Well, who'd not be happy if they were me?" demanded Bunch, rather confusedly. "With you and Susan and Edward, and all of you fond of me, and not caring if I'm stupid, and the sun shining, and this lovely big house to live in."
The Reverend Julian Harmon looked round the big bare dining room and assented doubtfully.
Some people would think it was the last straw to have to live in this great rambling, draughty place.
"Well, I like big rooms. All the nice smells from outside can get in and stay there. And you could be untidy and leave things about and they don't clutter you."
"No labour-saving devices or central heating. It means a lot of work for you, Bunch."
"Oh, Julian, it doesn't. I get up at 6:30 and light the boiler and rush around like a steam engine, and by 8 it's all done. And I keep it nice, don't I? With beeswax and polish and big jars of autumn leaves, it's not really harder to keep a big house clean than a small one. You go round with mops and things much quicker, because your behind isn't always bumping into things like it is in a small room. And I like sleeping in a big, cold room. It's so cosy to snuggle down with just the tip of your nose telling you what it's like up above. And whatever size of house you live in, you peel the same amount of potatoes and wash up the same amount of plates and all that. But think how nice it is for Edward and Susan to have a big empty room to play in, where they can have railways and dolls' tea parties all over the floor and never have to put them away. And then it's nice to have extra bits of the house that you can let people have to live in. Jimmy Symes and Johnny Finch, they'd have had to live with their in-laws otherwise. And you know, Julian, it isn't nice living with your in-laws. You're devoted to Mother, but you wouldn't really have liked to start our married life living with her and Father. and I shouldn't have liked it either. I'd have gone on feeling like a little girl. Julian smiled at her. You're rather like a little girl still, Bunch. Julian Harmon himself had clearly been a model designed by nature for the age of 60. He was still about 25 years short of achieving nature's purpose. Oh, I know I'm stupid. You're not stupid, Bunch. You're very clever. No, I'm not. I'm not a bit intellectual, though I do try. And I really love it when you talk to me about books and history and things. I think perhaps it wasn't an awfully good idea to read aloud Gibbon to me in the evenings, because if it's been a cold wind out and it's nice and hot by the fire, there's something about Gibbon that does rather make you go to sleep. Julian laughed. But I do love listening to you, Julian. Tell me the story again about the old vicar who preached about Ahasuerus. You know that by heart, Bunch. Just tell it me again, please. Her husband complied. It was old Scrimgeour. Somebody looked into his church one day. He was leaning out of the pulpit and preaching fervently to a couple of old charwomen. He was shaking his finger at them and saying, "Aha! I know what you're thinking. You think that the great Ahasuerus of the first lesson was Artaxerxes the second, but he wasn't. And then, with enormous triumph, he was Artaxerxes the third." It had never struck Julian Harmon as a particularly funny story himself, but it never failed to amuse Bunch. Her clear laugh floated out. "Oh, the old pet!" she exclaimed. "I think you'll be exactly like that some day, Julian." Julian looked rather uneasy. "I know," he said with humility. "I do feel very strongly that I can't always get the proper, simple approach." "I shouldn't worry," said Bunch, rising and beginning to pile the breakfast plates on a tray. "Mrs. Butt told me yesterday that Butt, who never went to church and used to be practically the local atheist, comes every Sunday now, on purpose, to hear you preach." She went on, with a very fair imitation of Mrs. Butt's super-refined voice. "And Butt was saying only the other day, madam, to Mr. Timkins from Little Worsdale, that we'd got real culture here in Chippingclaygon. Not like Mr. Goss at Little Worsdale, who talks to the congregation as though they were children who hadn't any education. Real culture, Butt said. That's what we've got. Our vicar's a highly educated gentleman, Oxford, not Milchester, and he gives us the full benefit of his education. All about the Romans and the Greeks he knows, and the Babylonians and the Assyrians too. And even the vicarage cat, Butt says, is called after an Assyrian king. So, there's glory for you," finished Bunch triumphantly. "Goodness, I must get on with things, or I shall never get done. Come along, Tiglath Pileser, you shall have the herringbones." Opening the door and holding it dexterously ajar with her foot, she shot through with the loaded tray, singing in a loud and not particularly tuneful voice her own version of a sporting song. "It's a fine murdering day, and as balmy as May, and the sleuths from the village are gone. Dee-dum!" The rattle of crockery being dumped in the sink drowned the next lines, but as the Reverend Julian Harmon left the house, he heard the final triumphant assertion. "And we'll all go a-murdering today." Chapter 2. Breakfast at Little Paddock's. At Little Paddock's also breakfast was in progress. Miss Blacklock, a woman of 60-odd, the owner of the house, sat at the head of the table. She wore country tweeds, and with them, rather incongruously, a choker necklace of large false pearls. She was reading Lane Norcott in the Daily Mail. Julia Simmons was languidly glancing through the Telegraph. Patrick Simmons was checking up on the crossword in the Times. Miss Dora Bunner was giving her attention wholeheartedly to the local weekly paper. Miss Blacklock gave a subdued chuckle. Patrick muttered, "Oh, adherent, not adhesive. That's where I went wrong." Suddenly a loud cluck like a startled hen came from Miss Bunner. Letty! Letty! Have you seen this? Whatever can it mean?
What's the matter, Dora?
This is a most extraordinary advertisement. It says little paddocks quite distinctly, but whatever can it mean?
If you'd let me see it, Dora, dear.
Miss Bunner obediently surrendered the paper into Miss Blacklock's outstretched hand, pointing to the item with a tremulous forefinger. I mean, just look, Letty.
Miss Blacklock looked. Her eyebrows went up. She threw a quick scrutinizing glance round the table. Then she read the advertisement out loud. A murder is announced and will take place on Friday, October the 29th, at Little Paddock's at 6:30 p.m. Friends, please accept this, the only intimation. Then she said sharply, Patrick, is this your idea? Her eyes rested searchingly on the handsome, devil-may-care face of the young man at the other end of the table. Patrick Simmons' disclaimer came quickly.
Oh, no, indeed, Aunt Letty.
Whatever put the idea into your head? Why should I know anything about it?
I wouldn't put it past you, said Miss Blacklock grimly. I thought it might be your idea of a joke.
A joke? Well, nothing of the kind.
And you, Julia?
Julia, looking bored, said, Of course not.
Miss Bunner murmured, Do you think Mrs. Hames... and looked at an empty place where someone had breakfasted earlier.
Oh, I don't think our Philippa would try and be funny, said Patrick. She's a serious girl, she is.
But what's the idea, anyway, said Julia, yawning.
What does it mean?
Miss Blacklock said slowly, I suppose it's some silly sort of hoax.
But why? Dora Bunner exclaimed. What's the point of it? It seems a very stupid sort of joke, and in very bad taste.
Her flabby cheeks quivered indignantly, and her short-sighted eyes sparkled with indignation. Miss Blacklock smiled at her.
Don't work yourself up over it, Bunny, she said. It's just somebody's idea of humour, but I wish I knew whose.
Well, it says today, pointed out Miss Bunner. Today? At 6:30 p.m. What do you think is going to happen?
Death, said Patrick in sepulchral tones. Delicious death.
Be quiet, Patrick, said Miss Blacklock, as Miss Bunner gave a little yelp.
I only meant the special cake that Mitzi makes, said Patrick apologetically. You know we always call it delicious death.
Miss Blacklock smiled a little absent-mindedly.
Miss Bunner persisted. But, Letty, what do you really think?
Her friend cut across the words with reassuring cheerfulness. I know one thing that will happen at 6:30, she said dryly. We'll have half the village up here, agog with curiosity. I'd better make sure we've got some sherry in the house.
You are worried, aren't you, Lottie?
Miss Blacklock started. She'd been sitting at her writing-table, absent-mindedly drawing little fishes on the blotting paper. She looked up into the anxious face of her old friend. She was not quite sure what to say to Dora Bunner. Bunny, she knew, mustn't be worried or upset. She was silent for a moment or two, thinking. She and Dora Bunner had been at school together. Dora then had been a pretty, fair-haired, blue-eyed, rather stupid girl. Her being stupid hadn't mattered because her gaiety and high spirits and her prettiness had made her an agreeable companion. She ought, her friend thought, to have married some nice army officer or a country solicitor. She had so many good qualities, affection, devotion, loyalty. But life had been unkind to Dora Bunner. She had had to earn her living. She had been painstaking but never competent at anything she undertook. The two friends had lost sight of each other, but 6 months ago a letter had come to Miss Blacklock, a rambling, pathetic letter. Dora's health had given way. She was living in one room, trying to subsist on her old-age pension. She endeavoured to do needlework, but her fingers were stiff with rheumatism. She mentioned their school days, since then life had driven them apart, but could, possibly, her old friend help?
Miss Blacklock had responded impulsively. Poor Dora. Poor, pretty, silly, fluffy Dora. She had swooped down upon Dora, had carried her off, had installed her at Little Paddock's, with the comforting fiction that the housework is getting too much for me, I need someone to help me in the house. It was not for long. The doctor had told her that. But sometimes she found poor old Dora a sad trial. She muddled everything, upset the temperamental foreign help, miscounted the laundry, lost bills and letters, and sometimes reduced the competent Miss Blacklock to an agony of exasperation. Poor old muddle-headed Dora, so loyal, so anxious to help, so pleased and proud to think she was of assistance, and, alas, so completely unreliable. She said sharply, "Don't, Dora. You know I asked you..." "Oh," Miss Bunner looked guilty. "I know. I forgot. But you are, aren't you?" "Worried? No. At least," she added truthfully, "not exactly." "You mean about that silly notice in the Gazette?" "Well, yes. Even if it's a joke, it seems to me it's a spiteful sort of joke."
"Spiteful?"
"Yes. It seems to me there's spite there somewhere. I mean, it's not a nice kind of joke." Miss Blacklock looked at her friend. The mild eyes, the long, obstinate mouth, the slightly upturned nose. Poor Dora. So maddening, so muddle-headed, so devoted, and such a problem. A dear, fussy old idiot, and yet, in a queer way, with an instinctive sense of values. "I think you're right, Dora," said Miss Blacklock. "It's not a nice joke." "I don't like it at all," said Dora Bunner with unsuspected vigour. "It frightens me." She added suddenly, "And it frightens you, Letitia." "Nonsense," said Miss Blacklock with spirit. "It's dangerous, I'm sure it is. It's like those people who send you bombs done up in parcels." "My dear, it's just some silly idiot trying to be funny." "But it isn't funny." It wasn't really very funny. Miss Blacklock's face betrayed her thoughts, and Dora cried triumphantly, "You see! You think so, too!" "But, Dora, my dear..." She broke off. Through the door there surged a tempestuous young woman with a well-developed bosom heaving under a tight jersey. She had on a dirndl skirt of a bright colour and had greasy dark plaits wound round and round her head. Her eyes were dark and flashing. She said gustily, "I can speak to you, yes, please. No?" Miss Blacklock sighed. "Oh, of course, Mitzi, what is it?" Sometimes she thought it would be preferable to do the entire work of the house as well as the cooking rather than be bothered with the eternal nerve storms of her refugee lady help.
"I tell you at once, it is in order, I hope. I give you my notices, and I go. I go at once."
"For what reason? Has someone upset you?"
"Yes, I am upset," said Mitzi dramatically. "I do not wish to die. Already in Europe, I escape. My family, they all die. They are all killed. My mother, my little brother, my so sweet little niece, all they are killed. But me, I run away, I hide, I get to England, I do work that I never would do in my own country. I
know all that," said Miss Blacklock crisply. It was indeed a constant refrain on Mitzi's lips. "But why do you want to leave now?"
"Because, again, they come to kill me."
"Who do?"
"My enemies, the Nazis, or perhaps this time it is the Bolsheviks. They find out I am here, they come to kill me. I have read it, yes. It is in the newspaper."
"Oh, you mean in the Gazette?"
"Here, it is written, here."
Mitzi produced the Gazette from where she'd been holding it behind her back.
"See, here it says, a murder. at Little Braddock's. That is here, is it not? This evening at 6:30? I do not wait to be murdered. No.
But why should this apply to you? It's... we think it's a joke.
A joke? It is not a joke to murder someone.
No, of course not. But, my dear child, if anyone wanted to murder you, they wouldn't advertise the fact in the paper, would they?
You do not think they would? Mitzi seemed a little shaken. You think perhaps they do not mean to murder anyone at all? Perhaps it is you who say mean to murder Miss Blacklock.
I certainly can't believe anyone wants to murder me, said Miss Blacklock lightly. And really, Mitzi, I don't see why anyone should want to murder you. After all, why should they?
Because they are bad peoples. Very bad peoples. I tell you, my mother, my little brother, my so sweet niece.
Yes, yes, Miss Blacklock stemmed the flow adroitly. But I cannot really believe anyone wants to murder you, Mitzi. Of course, if you want to go off like this at a moment's notice, I cannot possibly stop you. But I think you will be very silly if you do. She added firmly, as Mitzi looked doubtful. We'll have that beef the butcher sent stewed for lunch. It looks very tough. I make you a goulash, a special goulash. If you prefer to call it that, certainly. And perhaps you could use up that rather hard bit of cheese in making some cheese straws. I think some people may come in this evening for drinks.
This evening? What do you mean, this evening?
At 6:30.
But that is the time in the paper. Who should come then? Why should they come?
They're coming to the funeral, said Miss Blacklock with a twinkle. That'll do now, Mitzi. I'm busy. Shut the door after you, she added firmly. And that settled her for the moment, she said, as the door closed behind a puzzled-looking Mitzi.
You are so efficient, Letty, said Miss Bunner admiringly.
Chapter 3. At 6:30 p.m.
Well, here we are, all set, said Miss Blacklock. She looked round the double drawing-room with an appraising eye. The rose-patterned chintzes, the two bowls of bronze chrysanthemums, the small vase of violets, and the silver cigarette box on a table by the wall, the tray of drinks on the centre table. Little Paddock's was a medium-sized house built in the early Victorian style. It had a long, shallow veranda and green shuttered windows. The long, narrow drawing-room, which lost a good deal of light owing to the veranda roof, had originally had double doors at one end, leading into a small room with a bay window. A former generation had removed the double doors and replaced them with portières of velvet. Miss Blacklock had dispensed with the portières, so that the two rooms had become definitely one. There was a fireplace at each end, but neither fire was lit, although a gentle warmth pervaded the room.
"You've had the central heating lit," said Patrick.
Miss Blacklock nodded. "It's been so misty and damp lately. Whole house felt clammy. I got Evans to light it before he went."
"The precious, precious Coke?" said Patrick mockingly.
"As you say, the precious Coke. But otherwise there would have been the even more precious coal. You know the fuel office won't even let us have the little bit that's due to us each week. Not unless we can say definitely that we haven't got any other means of cooking.
I suppose there was once heaps of coal and coke for everybody, said Julia, with the interest of one hearing about an unknown country.
Yes, and cheap, too.
And anyone could go and buy as much as they wanted without filling in anything, and there wasn't any shortage.
There was lots of it there. All kinds, and qualities, and not all stones and slates like we get nowadays.
It must have been a wonderful world, said Julia, with awe in her voice.
Miss Blacklock smiled. Looking back on it, I certainly think so. But then I'm an old woman. It's natural for me to prefer my own times, but you young things oughtn't to think so.
I needn't have had a job then, said Julia. I could have just stayed at home and done the flowers and written notes.
Why did one write notes, and who were they to?
All the people that you now ring up on the telephone, said Miss Blacklock with a twinkle. I don't believe you even know how to write, Julia.
Not in the style of that delicious complete letter writer I found the other day. Heavenly! It told you the correct way of refusing a proposal of marriage from a widower.
I doubt if you would have enjoyed staying at home as much as you think, said Miss Blacklock. There were duties, you know. Her voice was dry. However, I don't really know much about it. Bunny and I, she smiled affectionately at Dora Bunner, went into the labour market early.
Oh, we did. We did indeed, agreed Miss Bunner. Those naughty, naughty children. I shall never forget them. Of course, Letty was clever. She was a businesswoman, secretary to a big financier.
The door opened and Philippa Hames came in. She was tall and fair and placid-looking. She looked round the room in surprise. Hello, she said. Is it a party? Nobody told me.
Of course, cried Patrick. Our Philippa doesn't know.
The only woman in Chipping Clayton who doesn't, I bet. Philippa looked at him inquiringly.
Here you behold, said Patrick dramatically, waving a hand, the scene of a murder.
Philippa Hames looked faintly puzzled. Here, Patrick indicated the two big bowls of chrysanthemums, are the funeral wreaths, and these dishes of cheese straws and olives represent the funeral baked meats. Philippa looked inquiringly at Miss Blacklock. Is it a joke? She asked. I'm always terribly stupid at seeing jokes.
It's a very nasty joke, said Dora Bunner with energy. I don't like it at all.
Show her the advertisement, said Miss Blacklock. I must go and shut up the ducks. It's dark. They'll be in by now.
Let me do it, said Philippa.
Certainly not, my dear. You've finished your day's work.
I'll do it, Aunt Letty, offered Patrick.
No, you won't, said Miss Blacklock with energy. Last time you didn't latch the door properly.
I'll do it, Letty, dear, cried Miss Bunner. Indeed, I should love to. I'll just slip on my galoshes. And now, where did I put my cardigan?
But Miss Blacklock, with a smile, had already left the room.
It's no good, Bunny, said Patrick.
Aunt Letty's so efficient that she can never bear anybody else to do things for her. She really much prefers to do everything herself.
She loves it, said Julia.
I didn't notice you making any offers of assistance, said her brother. Julia smiled lazily.
Well, you just said Aunt Letty likes to do things herself, she pointed out. Besides, she held out a well-shaped leg in a sheer stocking. I've got my best stockings on.
Death in silk stockings, declaimed Patrick.
They're not silk, nylons, you idiot.
No, that's not nearly such a good title.
Won't somebody please tell me, cried Philippa plaintively, why there is all this insistence on death?
Everybody tried to tell her at once. Nobody could find the Gazette to show her because Mitzi had taken it into the kitchen. Miss Blacklock returned a few minutes later.
There, she said briskly. That's done.
She glanced at the clock.
6:20.
Somebody ought to be here soon, unless I'm entirely wrong in my estimate of my neighbours.
I don't see why anybody should come, said Philippa, looking bewildered.
Don't you, dear? I dare say you wouldn't. But most people are rather more inquisitive than you are.
Philippa's attitude to life is that she just isn't interested, said Julia rather nastily.
Philippa did not reply. Miss Blacklock was glancing round the room. Mitzi had put the sherry and 3 dishes containing olives, cheese straws, and some little fancy pastries on the table in the middle of the room.
You might move that tray, or the whole table if you like, round the corner into the bay window in the other room, Patrick, if you don't mind. After all, I'm not giving a party.
I haven't asked anyone, and I don't intend to make it obvious that I expect people to turn up.
You wish, Aunt Letty, to disguise your intelligent anticipation.
Very nicely put, Patrick. Thank you, my dear boy.
Now we can all have a lovely performance of a quiet evening at home, said Julia, and be quite surprised when somebody drops in.
Miss Blacklock had picked up the sherry bottle. She stood holding it uncertainly in her hand. Patrick reassured her. There's quite half a bottle there. It ought to be enough.
Oh, yes.
She hesitated. Then, with a slight flush, she said, Patrick, would you mind? There's a new bottle in the cupboard in the pantry. Bring it and a corkscrew. We might as well have a new bottle. This has been opened some time. Patrick went on his errand without a word. He returned with the new bottle and drew the cork. He looked up curiously at Miss Blacklock as he placed it on the tray. Taking things seriously, aren't you, darling? He asked gently.
Oh, cried Dora Bunner, shocked. Oh, surely, Letty, you can't imagine.
Hush, said Miss Blacklock quickly. That's the bell. You see, my intelligent anticipation is being justified. Mitzi opened the door of the drawing-room and admitted Colonel and Mrs. Easterbrook. She had her own methods of announcing people.
Here is Colonel and Mrs. Easterbrook to see you, she said conversationally.
Colonel Easterbrook was very bluff and breezy to cover some slight embarrassment.
Hope you don't mind us dropping in, he said.
A subdued gurgle came from Julia.
Happened to be passing this way. What? Quite a mild evening. Oh, notice you've got your central heating on. We haven't started ours yet.
Aren't your chrysanthemums lovely? Gushed Mrs. Easterbrook. Such beauties.
Well, they're rather scraggy, really, said Julia. Mrs. Easterbrook greeted Philippa Hames with a little extra cordiality to show that she quite understood that Philippa was not really an agricultural labourer.
How is Mrs. Lucas's garden getting on? She asked. Do you think it will ever be straight again? Completely neglected all through the war, and then only that dreadful old man Ash, who simply did nothing but sweep up a few leaves and put in a few cabbage plants.
It's yielding to treatment, said Philippa, but it will take a little time. Mitzi opened the door again and said,
Here are the ladies from Boulder's.
Evening, said Miss Hinchcliffe, striding over and taking Miss Blacklock's hand in her formidable grip. I said to Murgatroyd, let's just drop in at Little Paddock's. I wanted to ask you how your ducks are laying.
The evenings do draw in quickly now, don't they? Said Miss Murgatroyd to Patrick in a rather fluttery way. What lovely chrysanthemums.
Scraggy, said Julia.
Why can't you be cooperative? Murmured Patrick to her in a reproachful aside.
You've got the central heating on, said Miss Hinchcliffe. She said it accusingly. Very early?
The house gets so damp at this time of year, said Miss Blacklock.
Patrick signalled with his eyebrows, sherry yet, and Miss Blacklock signalled back, not yet.
She said to Colonel Easterbrook, Are you getting any bulbs from Holland this year? The door opened again, and Mrs. Swettenham came in, rather guiltily, followed by a scowling and uncomfortable Edmund.
Here we are, said Mrs. Swettenham gaily, gazing round her with frank curiosity. Then, feeling suddenly uncomfortable, she went on, I just thought I'd pop in and ask you if by any chance you wanted a kitten, Miss Blacklock. Our cat is just about to be brought to bed of the progeny of a ginger tom, said Edmund. The result will, I think, be frightful. Don't say you haven't been warned.
She's a very good mouser, said Mrs. Swettenham hastily, and added, Oh, what lovely chrysanthemums.
You've got your central heating on, haven't you? Asked Edmund with an air of originality.
Aren't people just like gramophone records, murmured Julia.
I don't like the news, said Colonel Easterbrook to Patrick, buttonholing him fiercely. I don't like it at all. If you ask me, war's inevitable. Absolutely inevitable.
I never pay any attention to news, said Patrick. Once more the door opened, and Mrs. Harmon came in. Her battered felt hat was stuck on the back of her head in a vague attempt to be fashionable, and she had put on a rather limp, frilly blouse instead of her usual pullover.
"Hello, Miss Blacklock," she exclaimed, beaming all over her round face. "I'm not too late, am I? When does the murder begin?"
There was an audible series of gasps. Julia gave an approving little giggle. Patrick crinkled up his face, and Miss Blacklock smiled at her latest guest.
"Julian's just frantic with rage. He can't be here," said Mrs. Harmon. "He adores murders. That's really why he preached such a good sermon last Sunday. I suppose I oughtn't to say it was a good sermon, as he's my husband, but it really was good, didn't you think? So much better than his usual sermons. But as I was saying, it was all because of Death Does the Hat Trick. Have you read it? The girl at Boots kept it for me specially. It's simply baffling. You keep thinking you know, and then the whole thing switches round, and there are a lovely lot of murders, 4 or 5 of them. Well, I left it in the study when Julian was shutting himself up in there to do his sermon, and he just picked it up and simply could not put it down. And consequently, he had to write his sermon in a frightful hurry, and had to just put down what he wanted to say very simply, without any scholarly twists and bits and learned references. And naturally, it was heaps better. Oh, dear, I'm talking too much. But do tell me, when's the murder going to begin?
Miss Blacklock looked at the clock on the mantelpiece.
If it's going to begin, she said cheerfully, it ought to begin soon. It's just a minute to the half hour. In the meantime, have a glass of sherry.
Patrick moved with alacrity through the archway. Miss Blacklock went to the table by the archway where the cigarette box was.
I'd love some sherry, said Mrs. Harmon. But what do you mean by if?
Well, said Miss Blacklock, I'm as much in the dark as you are. I don't know what... She stopped and turned her head as the little clock on the mantelpiece began to chime. It had a sweet silvery bell-like tone. Everybody was silent, and nobody moved. They all stared at the clock. It chimed a quarter, and then the half. As the last note died away, all the lights went out. Delighted gasps and feminine squeaks of appreciation were heard in the darkness.
"It's beginning," cried Mrs. Harmon in ecstasy.
Dora Bunner's voice cried out plaintively,
"Oh, I don't like it."
Other voices said,
"How terribly, terribly frightening."
"It gives me the creeps."
"Archie, where are you?" "Oh, what do I have to do?"
"Oh, dear, did I step on your foot? I'm so sorry." Then, with a crash, the door swung open. A powerful flashlight played rapidly round the room. A man's hoarse, nasal voice, reminiscent to all of pleasant afternoons at the cinema, directed the company crisply to...
"Stink 'em up! Stink 'em up, I tell you!" the voice barked.
Delightedly, hands were raised willingly above heads.
"Oh, isn't it wonderful?" breathed the female voice. "I'm so thrilled!"
And then, unexpectedly, a revolver spoke. It spoke twice. The ping of 2 bullets shattered the complacency of the room. Suddenly the game was no longer a game. Somebody screamed. The figure in the doorway whirled suddenly round. It seemed to hesitate. A 3rd shot rang out. It crumpled, and then it crashed to the ground. The flashlight dropped and went out. There was darkness once again. And gently, with a little Victorian protesting moan, the drawing-room door, as was its habit when not propped open, swung gently to and latched with a click. Inside the drawing-room there was pandemonium. Various voices spoke at once.
"Lights! Can't you find the switch?"
"Who's got a lighter? Oh, I don't like it, I don't like it. But those shots were real."
"It was a real revolver he had."
"Was it a burglar? Oh, Archie, I want to get out of here."
"Please, has somebody got a lighter?"
And then, almost at the same moment, 2 lighters clicked and burned with small, steady flames. Everybody blinked and peered at each other. Startled face looked into startled face. Against the wall by the archway, Miss Blacklock stood with her hand up to her face. The light was too dim to show more than that something dark was trickling over her fingers. Colonel Easterbrook cleared his throat and rose to the occasion.
"Try the switches, Swetnam," he ordered.
Edmund, near the door, obediently jerked the switch up and down.
"Off at the main or a fuse," said the Colonel. Who's making that awful row?
A female voice had been screaming steadily from somewhere beyond the closed door. It rose now in pitch, and with it came the sound of fists hammering on a door. Dora Bunner, who had been sobbing quietly, called out, "It's Mitzi! Somebody's murdering Mitzi!" Patrick muttered, "No such luck." Miss Blacklock said, "We must get candles. Patrick, will you?" The Colonel was already opening the door. He and Edmund, their lighters flickering, stepped into the hall. They almost stumbled over a recumbent figure there.
"Seems to have knocked him out," said the Colonel. "Where's that woman making that hellish noise?"
"In the dining room," said Edmund. The dining room was just across the hall. Someone was beating on the panels and howling and screaming. "She's locked in," said Edmund, stooping down. He turned the key, and Mitzi came out like a bounding tiger. The dining room light was still on. Silhouetted against it, Mitzi presented a picture of insane terror and continued to scream. A touch of comedy was introduced by the fact that she had been engaged in cleaning silver and was still holding a chamois leather and a large fish slice.
"Be quiet, Mitzi," said Miss Blacklock. "Stop it," said Edmund.
And as Mitzi showed no disposition to stop screaming, he leaned forward and gave her a sharp slap on the cheek. Mitzi gasped and hiccuped into silence. "Get some candles," said Miss Blacklock, "in the kitchen cupboard. Patrick, you know where the fuse box is?" "The passage behind the scullery? Right, I'll see what I can do." Miss Blacklock had moved forward into the light thrown from the dining room, and Dora Bunner gave a sobbing gasp. Mitzi let out another full-blooded scream.
"The blood! The blood!" she gasped. "You are shot! Miss Blacklock, you bleed to death!"
"Don't be so stupid," snapped Miss Blacklock. "I'm hardly hurt at all. It just grazed my ear."
"But Aunt Letty," said Julia, "the blood!"
And indeed, Miss Blacklock's white blouse and pearls and her hand were a horrifyingly gory sight. "Ears always bleed," said Miss Blacklock. "I remember fainting in the hairdresser's when I was a child. The man had only just snipped my ear. There seemed to be a basin of blood at once. But we must have some light."
"I get the candles," said Mitzi.
Julia went with her, and they returned with several candles stuck into saucers.
"Now, let's have a look at our malefactor," said the Colonel. "Hold the candles down low, will you, Swettenham? As many as you can."
"I'll come the other side," said Philippa. With a steady hand, she took a couple of saucers. Colonel Easterbrook knelt down. The recumbent figure was draped in a roughly made black cloak with a hood to it. There was a black mask over the face, and he wore black cotton gloves. The hood had slipped back, disclosing a ruffled, fair head. Colonel Easterbrook turned him over, felt the pulse, the heart, then drew away his fingers with an exclamation of distaste, looking down on them. They were sticky and red.
"Shot himself," he said.
"Is he badly hurt?" asked Miss Blacklock.
"I'm afraid he's dead. May have been suicide, or he may have tripped himself up with that cloak thing, and the revolver went off as he fell. If I could see better..."
At that moment, as though by magic, the lights came on again. With a queer feeling of unreality, those inhabitants of Chipping Cleghorn who stood in the hall of Little Paddock's realized that they stood in the presence of violent and sudden death. Colonel Easterbrook's hand was stained red. Blood was still trickling down Miss Blacklock's neck over her blouse and coat, and the grotesquely sprawled figure of the intruder lay at their feet. Patrick, coming from the dining room, said,
"It seemed to be just one fuse gone."
He stopped. Colonel Easterbrook tugged at the small black mask.
"I'd better see who the fellow is," he said. "No, I don't suppose it's anyone we know."
He detached the mask. Necks were craned forward. Mitzi hiccuped and gasped, but the others were very quiet.
"He's quite young,"
said Mrs. Harmon, with a note of pity in her voice. And suddenly Dora Bunner cried out excitedly, "Oh, Letty! Letty! It's the young man from the Spa Hotel in Medenham Wells. The one who came out here and wanted you to give him money to get back to Switzerland, and you refused. I suppose the whole thing was just a pretext. To spy out the house. Oh, dear. He might easily have killed you." Miss Blacklock, in command of the situation, said incisively, "Philippa, take Bunny into the dining room and give her half a glass of brandy. Julia, dear, just run up to the bathroom and bring me the sticking plaster out of the bathroom cupboard. So messy, bleeding like a pig. Patrick, will you ring up the police at once?" Chapter 4. The Royal Spa Hotel. George Ridesdale, Chief Constable of Middleshire, was a quiet man, of medium height, with shrewd eyes under bushy brows. He was in the habit of listening rather than talking. Then, in his unemotional voice, he would give a brief order, and the order was obeyed. He was listening now to Detective Inspector Dermot Craddock. Craddock was now officially in charge of the case. Ridesdale had recalled him last night from Liverpool, where he had been sent to make certain inquiries in connection with another case. Ridesdale had a good opinion of Craddock. He not only had brains and imagination, he had also, which Ridesdale appreciated even more, the self-discipline to go slow, to check and examine each fact, and to keep an open mind until the very end of a case. "Constable Legg took the call, sir," Craddock was saying. "He seems to have acted very well, with promptitude and presence of mind, and it can't have been easy. About a dozen people all trying to talk at once, including one of those Mittel Europas who go off at the deep end at the mere sight of a policeman, made sure she was going to be locked up and fairly screamed the place down." "Deceased has been identified?" "Yes, sir. Rudy Schertz, Swiss nationality, employed at the Royal Spa Hotel, Medenham Wells, as a receptionist. If you agree, sir, I thought I'd take the Royal Spa Hotel first and go out to Chipping Cleghorn afterwards. Sergeant Fletcher's out there now. He'll see the bus people and then go on to the house." Ridesdale nodded approval. The door opened and the chief constable looked up. "Come in, Henry," he said. "We've got something here that's a little out of the ordinary." Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard, came in with slightly raised eyebrows. He was a tall, distinguished-looking elderly man. "It may appeal to even your blasé palate," went on Ridesdale. "I was never blasé," said Sir Henry indignantly. "The latest idea," said Ridesdale, "is to advertise one's murders beforehand. Show Sir Henry that advertisement, Craddock." "The North Benham News in Chipping Cleghorn Gazette," said Sir Henry. "Quite a mouthful." He read the half-inch of print indicated by Craddock's finger. Yes, somewhat unusual." "Any line on who inserted this advertisement?" asked Ridesdale. "By the description, sir, it was handed in by Rudy Schertz himself on Wednesday." "Nobody questioned it? The person who accepted it didn't think it odd?" "The adenoidal blonde who receives the advertisements is quite incapable of thinking, I should say, sir. She just counted the words and took the money." "What was the idea?" asked Sir Henry. "Get a lot of the locals curious," suggested Ridesdale. "Get them all together at a particular place at a particular time, then hold them up and relieve them of their spare cash and valuables. As an idea, it's not without originality." "What sort of place is Chipping Cleghorn?" asked Sir Henry. "A large, sprawling, picturesque village. Butcher, baker, grocer, quite a good antique shop, two tea shops. Self-consciously a beauty spot. Caters for the motoring tourist. Also highly residential.
cottages formerly lived in by agricultural labourers now converted and lived in by elderly spinsters and retired couples. A certain amount of building done round about in Victorian times. I know, said Sir Henry. Nice old pussies and retired colonels. Yes, if they'd noticed that advertisement, they'd all come sniffing round at 6:30 to see what was up. Lord, I wish I had my own particular old pussy here. Wouldn't she like to get her nice ladylike teeth into this? Right up her street it'd be. Who's your own particular pussy, Henry? An aunt? No, Sir Henry sighed. She's no relation. He said reverently, she's just the finest detective God ever made. Natural genius cultivated in a suitable soil. He turned upon Craddock. Don't you despise the old pussies in this village of yours, my boy, he said. In case this turns out to be a high-powered mystery, which I don't suppose for a moment it will, remember that an elderly, unmarried woman who knits and gardens is streets ahead of any detective sergeant. She can tell you what might have happened and what ought to have happened, and even what actually did happen. And she can tell you why it happened. I'll bear that in mind, sir, said Detective Inspector Craddock in his most formal manner. And nobody would have guessed that Dermot Eric Craddock was actually Sir Henry's godson and was on easy and intimate terms with his godfather. Ridesdale gave a quick outline of the case to his friend. And they'd all turn up at 6:30, I grant you that, he said. But would that Swiss fellow know they would? And another thing. Would they be likely to have much loot on them to be worth the taking? A couple of old-fashioned brooches, a string of seed pearls, a little loose change, perhaps a note or two, not more, said Sir Henry thoughtfully. Did this Miss Blacklock keep much money in the house? She says not, sir. £5 odd, I understand. But mere chicken feed, said Ridesdale. What you're getting at, said Sir Henry, is that this fellow liked to play-act. It wasn't the loot. It was the fun of playing and acting the hold-up. Cinema stuff, eh? It's quite possible. How did he manage to shoot himself? Ridesdale drew a paper towards him. Preliminary medical report. The revolver was discharged at close range. Singeing. Nothing to show whether accident or suicide. Could have been done deliberately, or he could have tripped and fallen, and the revolver which he was holding close to him could have gone off. Probably the latter. He looked at Craddock. You'll have to question the witnesses very carefully and make them say exactly what they saw. Detective Inspector Craddock said sadly, well, they'll all have seen something different. It's always interested me, said Sir Henry, what people do see at a moment of intense excitement and nervous strain. What they do see, and even more interesting, what they don't see. Where's the report on the revolver? A foreign make, fairly common on the continent. Shirts did not hold a permit for it, and did not declare it on coming into England. Bad lad, said Sir Henry. Unsatisfactory character all round. Well, Craddock, go and see what you can find out about him at the Royal Spa Hotel. At the Royal Spa Hotel, Inspector Craddock was taken straight to the manager's office. The manager, Mr. Rowlandson, a tall, florid man with a hearty manner, greeted Inspector Craddock with expansive geniality. "Oh, glad to help you in any way we can, Inspector," he said. "Really, most surprising business. I'd never have credited it, never. Shirt seemed a very ordinary, pleasant young chap. Not at all my idea of a hold-up man. How long has he been with you, Mr. Rowlandson?"
I was looking that up just before you came, a little over 3 months. Quite good credentials, usual permits, etc.
And you found him satisfactory? Without seeming to do so,
Craddock marked the infinitesimal pause before Rowlandson replied, "Quite satisfactory." Craddock made use of a technique he had found efficacious before now. "No, no, Mr. Rowlandson," he said, gently shaking his head. "That's not really quite the case, is it?"
Well, the manager seemed slightly taken aback.
"Come now. There was something wrong. What was it?"
"That's just it. I don't know."
"But you thought there was something wrong?"
"Well, yes, I did. But I've nothing really to go on. I shouldn't like my conjectures to be written down and quoted against me."
Craddock smiled pleasantly.
"I know just what you mean. You needn't worry.
But I've got to get some idea of what this fellow Schertz was like. You suspected him of what?" Rowlandson said rather reluctantly,
"Well, there was trouble once or twice about the bills. Items charged that oughtn't to have been there."
"You mean you suspected that he charged up certain items which didn't appear in the hotel records and that he pocketed the difference when the bill was paid?"
"Well, something like that. Put it at the best, there was gross carelessness on his part. Once or twice quite a big sum was involved. Frankly, I got our accountant to go over his books, suspecting that he was, a wrong'un. But though there were various mistakes and a good deal of slipshod method, the actual cash was quite correct. So I came to the conclusion that I must be mistaken."
"Supposing you hadn't been wrong? Supposing Schertz had been helping himself to various small sums here and there, he could have covered himself, I suppose, by making good the money?"
"Yes, if he had the money. But people who help themselves to small sums, as you put it, are usually hard up for those sums and spend them offhand."
"So if he wanted money to replace missing sums, he would have had to get money by a hold-up or other means?"
"Yes. I wonder if this was his first attempt."
"Might be. It was certainly a very amateurish one. Is there anyone else he could have got money from? Any women in his life?"
"Oh, one of the waitresses in the grill. Her name's Myrna Harris."
"I'd better have a talk with her." Myrna Harris was a pretty girl with a glorious head of red hair and a pert nose. She was alarmed and wary, and deeply conscious of the indignity of being interviewed by the police.
"I don't know a thing about it, sir, not a thing," she protested. "If I'd known what he was like, I'd never gone out with Rudy at all. Well, naturally, seeing as he worked in reception here, I thought he was all right. Well, naturally, I did. What I say is the hotel ought to be more careful when they employ people, especially foreigners, because you never know where you are with foreigners. I suppose he might have been with one of these gangs you read about."
"We think," said Craddock, "that he was working quite on his own."
"Oh, fancy. And him so quiet and respectable. You'd never think. Though there have been things missed, now I come to think of it. A diamond brooch and a little gold locket, I believe. But I never dreamed that it could have been Rudy."
"I'm sure you didn't," said Craddock. "Anyone might have been taken in." "You knew him fairly well?"
"I don't know that I'd say well."
"But you were friendly?"
"Oh, we were friendly. That's all. Just friendly. Nothing serious at all. I'm always on my guard with foreigners, anyway. They've often got away with them, but you never know, do you? Some of those Poles during the war, and even some of the Americans, never let on their married men until it's too late. Rudy talked big and all that, but I always took it with a grain of salt."
Craddock seized on the phrase. "Talked big, did he? That's very interesting, Miss Harris. I can see you're going to be a lot of help to us. In what way did he talk big?"
"Well, about how rich his people were in Switzerland, and how important. But that didn't go with his being as short of money as he was.
He always said that because of the money regulation, he couldn't get money from Switzerland over here. Well, that might be, I suppose, but his things weren't expensive. His clothes, I mean. They weren't really class. I think, too, that a lot of the stories he used to tell me were so much hot air, about climbing in the Alps and saving people's lives on the edge of a glacier. Why, he turned quite giddy just going along the edge of Boulter's Gorge. Alps, indeed. You went out with him a good deal? Yes, well, yes, I did. He had awfully good manners, and he knew how to look after a girl. The best seats at pictures, always. Even flowers he'd buy me sometimes. And he was just a lovely dancer. Lovely. Did he mention this Miss Blacklock to you at all? She comes in and lunches here sometimes, doesn't she? And she stayed here once. No, I don't think Rudy ever mentioned her. I didn't know he knew her. Did he mention Chipping Cleghorn? He thought a faintly wary look came into Myrna Harris's eyes, but he couldn't be sure. I don't think so. I think he did once ask about buses, what time they went. But I can't remember if it was Chipping Cleghorn or somewhere else. It wasn't just lately. He couldn't get more out of her. Rudy's shirts had seemed just as usual. She hadn't seen him the evening before. She'd no idea, no idea at all, she stressed the point, that Rudy Shirts was a crook. And probably, Craddock thought, that was quite true.
End of Disc 1.